Good morning. It is really a pleasure, I should say a long due pleasure, to introduce to you today Álvaro Pascual Leone. Álvaro has done his MD, PhD in a combined program between Spain and Germany just a couple of years ago. No, not really. And from there, he came to the States where he studied with, he did his neurology residency at the University of Minnesota. He then came to NIH, and he's known to several of us sitting in this audience from his NIH days where he collaborated, where he worked mainly with Mark Hallett. And he collaborated with also with Eric Wasserman, with Jordan Grafman, Christy Ludlow, and myself in a number of different projects in a number of different directions. He was extremely prolific during his stay here and moved on to establish his own program going back to Spain at the Instituto Ramón y Cajal in Madrid. And after some time there, which I don't know if it was months or years or weeks, oh, no, 3 years, he moved on to Boston, where he really developed very, very rapidly into his present position. He has been prolific in his last years, and he has been one of the main investigators in the areas of in which trying to understand essentially fundamental problems in cognitive neuroscience. He has been one of the main developers of different brain stimulation techniques, both with the purpose of understanding mechanisms of human psychological and neurological functions and cognitive functions, as well as interventional approaches. So it is really a pleasure, and in his present position at this time, he's a professor of neurology and chief of the brain stimulation lab at the Harvard Medical School. All the titles are there, and they have a very important endowment that he's going to talk to you about, because I don't remember the name. But it's really a great, great pleasure to introduce to you Álvaro, who hasn't been here for a very long time, and welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be here. I want to thank you all for having me, and particularly to Leo for hosting me. It feels sort of like coming home for me. I have the feeling that a lot of the fundamental ways of thinking of both how to implement research questions as well as how to think about brain and brain function and the relationship to behavior that I continue having were set during the years that I was here. And so as a sort of disclaimer, I may be going too much out of on a limb with this talk, but it is in the spirit of feeling that I'm among friends, and so can venture out into areas that perhaps I would be more cautious into venturing in. But what I was hoping to do is, rather than just tell you about some experiments that have been going on in the lab, to try to put it into a broader context, a provocative one at that. Just in terms of disclosures, I'm going to be telling you about investigational uses of non-invasive brain stimulation techniques, both TMS and TDCS. I wish I did, but I don't have any financial interests in any of the techniques I'm going to be telling you about. And the work that we've been conducting is supported mainly by various NIH grants, but also by the Nancy Lurie Marks Foundation and more recently the Berens and Allen Foundation. So here's the sort of broad picture framework. If we think about what drives our decision-making and our behavior, going back to Charles Darwin, one would argue that as animals, we are as driven by survival of the fittest and therefore by self-centered behaviors as any of the other species around. And yet, as President Clinton most recently, just a few weeks ago, at the Potomac School argued, humans are essentially interdependent beings. We don't just exist for the sake of our own, but because and thanks to the interaction with others, or so we hope. Those interactions don't always play out well, but nonetheless, that's the reason for being. And the goal should be to have some sort of rules that govern social interactions and develop culture. And of course, there is a lot of anthropology of the evolution of culture that comes to modify the predictions that Darwin would have made. But ultimately, it becomes necessary, I shall argue, to have some sort of mechanism by which this perception of the interdependence and the rules that govern social interactions can control self-centered behaviors. Otherwise, protection of the common good and society in general would not function. At the same time, there is some fundamentally unique properties of human beings. In a sense, we're sort of evolutionary outliers. I think one may be able to argue, and Ernst Fehr has done so, that humans, by virtue of the fact that we can and do focus on culture and social norms, including issues like fairness, reciprocity, equity, etc., develop a number of traits that are not really compatible with purely survival of the fittest, self-centered behaviors. Think, for example, of altruism, where truly selfless giving of oneself to others without any kind of secondary motif for the individual is not only something that humans do, but actually that we as humans admire. Now, why is that the case, and what is the neural substrate of that? Well, so I should argue that perhaps Freud had it right, and that in the structural theory of the mind, where he argues that in addition to the ego, rational processes, and the instinctual drives, there was a superego. That in fact, that sort of superego that exerts repression of instinctual drives is indeed a way of describing these mechanisms by which interdependence-driven motifs can control self-centered motifs. If you think about it, without the overlay of the social rejection of the term, as it were, repression, the way that Freud introduced it, is actually a dynamic influence that balances self-centered behaviors and controls impulsive drives. And he describes this as a uniquely critical human faculty. What I'd like to share with you is a series of experiments in trying to look at the potential neural substrate of those mechanisms and hopefully suggesting that the prefrontal cortex may, particularly the right prefrontal cortex, may be just the site where those control mechanisms sit. If that is the case, if we're able to identify the neural substrate, then there might be translational opportunities in a variety of neuropsychiatric disorders, and I'd like to share some of that with you. Now, if you want to put this in sort of more modern terms, perhaps there is a number of models that have been put forward from social psychology. This one I like particularly, the dual process model that Sutpute and Lieberman put forth. And they separate out reflexive processes from reflective processes. Reflexive processes being automatic processes that operate very fast, learn very slow, have intrinsically very little plasticity, and are phylogenetically older. You can think about it as emotional-driven responses, and the neural substrate for which often involve subcortical structures, amygdala, and so forth. And this is opposed by a reflective mode of operation, control processes that operate much slower, but learn very fast, change dynamically, and they provide substrates for dealing with special cases and abstract concepts. The key component of that reflective system is the dorsal prefrontal cortex, or at least the lateral prefrontal cortex. And I'll try to put the results of our experiments in the context of this sort of processing. And the question then is, can we influence human behavior by modulating the reflective system? If we're able to do that, as I was saying, then I think we might have a means of better understanding the uniquely human aspects of behavior and translate them into help in human disease. It will open up a tremendous ethical debate if it's true that we can modify ethical behavior at that point. And as I hope to show you, I think we can. And I think as investigators, we should enter the ethical debate proactively. All right, so let me get to experimental data and stop with the intro. The right lateral prefrontal cortex has been shown on a variety of different tasks to play a fundamental role when inhibition of behavior is needed. There is a number of tasks that people have used from the Wisconsin card sorting task, from to go, no, go, and stop signal paradigms, as well as tasks. Set switching, and in fact the data both in primates as well as in humans suggests that the dorsal prefrontal cortex, certainly the lateral prefrontal cortex, is critically engaged in any one of those tasks. This is a meta-analysis from Aaron and Poltrak from a couple of years ago showing that the common area of interest across all these tasks that involve some sort of inhibition of performance ends up localizing to the right lateral prefrontal cortex. So with that in mind, set out to explore, Daria Knoch set out to explore the ultimatum game, a very interesting neuroeconomics game that Ernst Fehr, with whom Daria Knoch works now, has been exploring carefully. The setup is as follows. There is a proposer and a responder. The proposer and the responder are paired, and they're given a set amount of money, say $20. And the proposer is then asked to propose a split of that amount of money. Anything goes. The proposer can say, I'll keep the $20, he gets nothing. Or can say, like in this example here, I'll keep 16 and he gets 4. Or can say, he gets the 20 and I'll get nothing. Anything is okay. But the proposer can only propose one such split. The responder, on the other hand, cannot negotiate, can simply say, I'll take it or I won't. If the responder takes it, then the proposed split is what they will get. If the responder declines the offer, then neither one, proposer or responder, will get any money. So, very simple. Now, if you think about it, these two folks, there is no reason why one should be better than the other. They are told that they are randomly assigned to these two roles. So there is really no reason why proposers should not offer 50-50 splits, but they don't. We're not that good. Now, on the other hand, there is no reason why responders should not take any offer, because they had nothing to begin with, and if they're offered $4, that's better than going home without anything. So from a pure self-motivation motive, responders should always accept, but they don't. They don't, because there is this balance beam relationship between self-interest on the one hand and then fairness, equity, and reciprocity motifs. It just doesn't seem right that he should get 16 and I should get 4. Why? What kind of entitlement is that? And so as it turns out, humans are willing to do what neuroeconomics folks call altruistic punishment, which I think is a great word. So they will reject low offers. And in fact, they will reject low offers when the stakes are even as high as 3 months their own salary income, which is staggering if you think about it. The rejection rates of up to 80% for offers below 25% of the available money are common ground. So if you have the feeling that the offer is unfair, you reject, even though it'll hurt you, because you won't get anything. Now, San Fei and John Cohen and others have done very elegant functional imaging work on the neural substrate of this phenomenon. Of course, the person of interest is really the responder. The proposer, even though the responder is told that the proposer is randomly assigned, is really part of the experimental team. They're in the know. But if you look at the brain activity in the responders during the decisions to accept or reject offers, what San Fei and colleagues found is that there is primarily two areas of activation during the rejection response or during the acceptance response for unfair offers. The dorsal prefrontal cortex, as you can see here, particularly on the right, and the anterior insula bilaterally. In fact, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex activity is correlated in its activity with the unfairness of the offer. And what San Fei and colleagues concluded is that the lateral prefrontal cortex is involved in the control of the emotional impulse to reject the unfair offer. So it just doesn't feel right, but I need to control that emotional response. And so that cognitive control of emotional impulse is associated ultimately with fairness goals, and that's what activates the prefrontal cortex. That's what they conclude. There is an alternative way of thinking about it. The alternative way of thinking about it is that the prefrontal cortex may be involved in the inhibition of the selfish impulse, so that the impulse initially is not, how does he dare do offer me something unfair, but rather, I want that. I want the $4. I want whatever I'm getting. And that secondarily, a response driven by prefrontal cortex aims to suppress that initial selfish impulse, self-centered impulse. So these are very different hypotheses and very different ways of thinking of the prefrontal cortex. But in addition to that, it leads to very different predictions for the disruption of the lateral prefrontal cortex activity. If the prefrontal cortex exerts cognitive control on the suppression of fairness impulses, as San Fei and colleagues hypothesize, then if you disrupt the lateral prefrontal cortex, that should reduce the acceptance of unfair offers. On the other hand, if the lateral prefrontal cortex suppresses selfish impulses, then suppression of that activity should increase the acceptance rate of unfair offers. So you have sort of a completely opposite prediction for the suppression of the activity in the prefrontal cortex. In order to suppress the activity in the prefrontal cortex, what Daria used was transcranial magnetic stimulation. And I think you're all familiar with this, so I won't spend much time. But basically, electromagnetic induction is generated by discharging a bank of capacitors and passing a few thousands of amperes very quickly in a matter of milliseconds through a stimulation coil. The coil shape determines the distribution of current in the brain. The experiment that Daria did use a relatively focal H-shaped coil that targets an area of about 0.5 by 0.5 centimeters at the cortical level. She used frameless stereotaxy to make sure that each stimulation was targeting the same and desired area of the brain of the subjects. At least the main dipole of the current was targeting that area. And she informed the target, defined the target, not like here, which is targeting the motor cortex, but in fact, by using the subject's own functional MRI. And she applied repetitive stimulation rather than single pulse stimulation. And when you apply repetitive stimulation, you can render the targeted area either hypoactive for some period of time subsequently or suppress in its activity. This is a 2DG study that Tony Valero did in anesthetized cats to show these offline lasting effects of the stimulation. And you can see that as compared with sham stimulation, the 2DG uptake, the metabolic activities decrease. after 1 hertz stimulation. You can also modulate in the inverse direction by increasing the frequency of bursting patterns. But what Daria used was this form of slow 1 hertz stimulation. So what happens in the experiment, in the ultimatum game? If you look at the acceptance rate for the unfair offer of 16-4, or any other unfair offer, then sham stimulation doesn't lead to a change in acceptance as compared with left-sided real stimulation. However, when the right-sided prefrontal cortex is targeted and suppressed in its activity, targeted with 1 hertz, then the acceptance rate goes dramatically up. What is interesting is that the acceptance rate goes dramatically up even though the perceived fairness or unfairness of the offer doesn't change. Subjects still feel this is completely unfair. They just take it. They're not willing to punish anymore. And in fact, they take it very quickly. They take it quicker than in the other conditions. If you think about it from another point of view, they just go with their first impulse. And I shall argue that's a self-centered, selfish impulse. Now, when a human proposer sits in front of you and gives you the offer, then there is self-interest at play from the responder's point of view. There is fairness and equity at play. And there is also reciprocity at play. You want to get back to them. If you're only giving me 4, you're not taking 16 kind of attitude. Now, you can play the exact same game having different computers in front of you and being told that the computer randomly is making up an offer. What is nice about that is that the self-interest is not changed. The proposer still, the responder still wants to keep the money. But the fairness and equity is probably less, and certainly the reciprocity is no longer there, because who are you going to get back at? A piece of machinery. So we compared, Daria compared the effect of targeting the dorsal prefrontal cortex in this condition, which I just showed you, with the results when a computer made the offers. Now, the offers that the computers made were exactly the same ones that the proposers had just made. Since each subject played the game 20 times with 20 different proposers, it's hard for them to remember what order and exactly what, and in fact they didn't remember what offers were given. So we can directly compare the same offers and how subjects respond to it. Now what you see here is that overall the acceptance rate of an unfair offer, 16-4, is higher than it was before. That is because there is no reciprocity at hand, so the willingness to punish altruistically, as it were, the proposer is not really there. In addition to that, you see that now the right-sided stimulation in the middle does no longer change performance. In fact, real or sham stimulation all have the same impact. There is no impact on the acceptance. There is no impact on the fairness judgment. There is a slight tendency for the response time to be shorter, just like we had before, but this doesn't reach significant, and it doesn't impact on the acceptance rate. So it looks like the left-sided the right prefrontal cortex, not the left, is playing a role in suppressing this sort of self-centered behaviors and leading, when suppressed, to a more impulsive interaction. Now, the nature of the social interactions oftentimes involves many subjects, not just one subject at a time. And in fact, the results of games just like this one, like the ultimatum game, is quite different if you play it more than once with the same partner. So you want to be playing these games once with each different partner. And it does make a difference if the partner is there or the partner is not. And so therefore, it'd be nice to have the possibility of having all these multiple partners that you're playing with all together at the same time in the same room and some of them having modulation to the left, some to the right, some sham modulation with the cortical stimulation. So you don't have to do serial testing, but can do it all in parallel, as indeed the behavioral tests have been done. That is very difficult to do with transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is involved big machine, clicking noises, and so forth. But it can be readily done with another form of non-invasive brain stimulation, with transcranial DC current stimulation. A transcranial DC current stimulation is a very simple way of modifying the resting firing rates of neurons in a targeted area. Basically, a current is passed, a constant current of about 1 to 2 milliamps is passed between an anode and a cathode. If you model what goes on, most of that current will be shunted by the skin and the scalp and never penetrate the brain, but a significant amount does get into the cortex. This is a realistic head model that Tim Wagner generated and will affect the targeted region. The kind of effect that it will exert depends on whether you look under the anode or under the cathode. Under the anode, the firing rate of the targeted neurons increases, as shown here by Purpura in 1964. Under the cathode, the firing rates of resting of neurons under the cathode will decrease. And the hypothesis is that what goes on is that the resting membrane potential is shifted by changes in membrane excitability, even though that physiology is not completely clear-cut. But it certainly is not enough current to induce a stimulation effect with depolarization, but it is enough to exert a neuromodulatory effect. So instead of applying the stimulation and sometime later testing the subjects, as in the case of the magnetic stimulation, what we'll be doing here is applying the stimulation and testing the subjects while the stimulation is ongoing, while the activity in the targeted area presumably is modified. It is certainly much less focal also than the magnetic stimulation can be. But what you see here is that the effect of modifying the activity in the right lateral prefrontal cortex, is the same as we had with the magnetic stimulation. This was done with Swiss franc rather than with dollars. You can see that when the offer to split the 20 was 10-10, then, of course, there is no impact on the acceptance rate. No surprise there. If they give me a fair share, then I'll take it. What is interesting is the end down here, when the proposer offers 4 for the responder and to keep 16. This is the same condition that I was showing you before. And again, the amount of acceptance rate goes significantly up when the subjects are performing under cathodal stimulation to the right prefrontal cortex. So suppressing the right prefrontal cortex. And like we had before, the fairness judgment is not changed. So those experiments suggest that it is possible to modify the response without altering the fairness judgment, and that suppression of the right and not the left lateral prefrontal cortex leads to an increase in the acceptance rate for unfair offers, which is consistent not with Sunfay's hypothesis, but actually with the hypothesis that the lateral prefrontal cortex suppresses the self-centered impulses. Now, if you notice, and I pointed out in the experiments, those trials where the subject just accepted were also faster. And indeed, self-centered behaviors become critical to balance in risk-taking impulses. So could one find the same role of the lateral prefrontal cortex in risk-taking tasks, as would be predicted by the impulsive nature of the responses? Indeed, decisions over time show the same type of split between two different neural networks as predicted by the reflexive and reflective modes of operation. Impulsive, fast decisions, probably driven largely by affective mechanisms, activate a network of areas that overlaps rather nicely with these reflexive responses, whereas deliberate reflective decisions activate areas that map well to the reflective decisions, and where, again, the lateral prefrontal cortex appears to play a fundamental role. So this is the risk task that we look to do. The subject sits in front of a computer screen, and six little boxes appear. They can be in pink or in green. The number of boxes in pink and green can vary. The goal of the task is to find the winning token, the golden token, which is hidden in one of these boxes. And in fact, what you want the subject to give you is the color of the box under which the winning token will be. Each box has the same probability of hiding the winning token. So there is a 1 in 6 probability that the winning token will be in any one of these boxes. So in this particular trial, if you were to say green, you would be 5/6 likely to be correct, and only 1/6 likely to be correct if you said pink. Right? So the probability of your choice, the risk that you're taking by picking one color, is explicitly given to you. There's also a balance of payoff, as it were, that is explicitly given. If you pick green, then you will get $20. If you pick pink and are correct, you will get $80. So now you can balance out what amounts to the level of risk that you're taking by the probability, as well as the balance of the reward. And you can look separately at the impact of these two different variables. This is, again, transcranial magnetic stimulation. But instead of applying offline for some period of time and then testing the subjects for a while, we did trains of stimulation before each trial. And this is what happens. The stimulation could be to the left or to the right, or sham. What you can see is that the number of points, money, that overall the subjects take with them is significantly less when the right prefrontal cortex is suppressed by the stimulation as compared with when the stimulation targets the left or sham stimulation is applied. And the reason why they take less number of points, they collect less points and take less money, is because they actually choose lower risk prospects less often. They're, put it differently, they are guided by the potential of reward and take the higher risk option significantly more often. But it is not because of a change in the balance of reward. The response curve of their choices with the balance of response is the same as with the other conditions. So the responses are modulated in the same manner with the differences in the balance of response. Overall, the curve is just shifted down so that they are more willing to take higher risk. In fact, so much higher risk that they end up losing. So suppression of the right lateral prefrontal cortex leads to an increased risk-taking behavior, so much so that it ends up in this particular task where excessive risk-taking behavior leads to a loss, leading them to lose money. Again, this suggests that the lateral prefrontal cortex, and again on the right, not on the left, suppresses impulsive self-centered behaviors. Now, that's nice, but if one is interested in sort of a translational application, it would be nicer to increase activity in the lateral prefrontal cortex and make people more cautious rather than making them more risky. Particularly if you're from Spain, people are risky enough. What you want is to try to modify the other way around. Aside from the joke, clinical applications generally would want to do the opposite modulation than what I've been showing you. So Shirley Fecteau set up to do that. I've shown you that transcranial DC current stimulation, depending on whether you apply anodal versus cathodal stimulation, can either increase or decrease the activity in the targeted area. And so using the same risk task that I just showed you, Shirley applied either anodal or cathodal stimulation to the right side to increase activity in the right lateral prefrontal cortex by applying a node and compare that to the cathodal situation. And what we found is that indeed the choice of the low-risk prospects now was significantly increased by the right-sided stimulation. So when you increase with the anodal stimulation, when you increase the activity in the right prefrontal cortex, then subjects become more cautious in their choices, just the opposite modulation that I just showed you. In this particular task, since that is a good thing to play the task, you end up making more points and taking more money and winning. So increasing the activity in the right prefrontal cortex decreases the risk-taking behavior. Again, consistent with this notion of an executive control of the right prefrontal cortex on impulsive self-centered behaviors. However, in this particular task that I've been showing you, the level of risk is known. I've pointed that out in terms of the design of the task. In life, the level of risk is generally not known. You guess it, but you don't actually know it. And so it'd be nice to have a more ecologically valid task to try to explore this. And such a task does exist. A number of those tasks exist. One particularly simple one is the BART. This is the following conundrum. The subject sits in front of a computer screen, and there is a balloon in there. And the subject has to push a button, and every time you push the button, you get some points. Eventually, you are paid by the number of points that you have, so you're collecting money every time you push the button. With each push of the button, the balloon pumps up. And at some point, the balloon will burst. But you don't know when the balloon will burst. And each balloon that you have to play will have a different bursting point. At any point, you can say, okay, I've pumped it enough. I collect the money and keep that. Or you can keep going and risking collecting more money versus the balloon bursting and losing it all. Okay? So at any given point, you can say, I'll cash it in, or I'll keep pumping. If you keep pumping and it bursts, you lose it. So very simple. The different, particularly critical variable here is that the risk is unknown here, because the balloon every time can burst at a different time point. Now, there is another thing about the experiments that I've shown you that we don't know for sure. We're targeting one dorsal prefrontal cortex, and of course, there is an interhemispheric interaction, and so when you increase activity in one side, you decrease it in the other, particularly when you do so with transcranial DC current stimulation, putting the two electrodes, one on the homolog area of the other. One is the anode, but the other is the cathode. And so one thing that would be nice to know is whether it is particularly important to have bilateral modulation, increase one as compared to the other prefrontal activity, versus whether just simply the modulation of one side is sufficient. And so what Shirley did was compare bilateral with unilateral modulation of activity in the prefrontal cortex in addition to this particular task that looks at risk as an unpredictable variable. And what you see here is the results. The average number of pumps adjusted for the bursts. So the number of pumps that people go through and are willing to keep going until the balloon bursts are significantly decreased by stimulation bilaterally. And it actually doesn't matter whether the anode is on the right or on the left in this particular case. So whether you tilt the balance of activity between the two prefrontal cortices in one direction or another, in both cases, you decrease the number of pumps that the subjects do. Unilateral stimulation, either right or left, doesn't do it. Consistent with that, the total number of money that subjects earn is actually decreased. They play it too cautiously. And they don't push the task to what it can give you. If you actually push the first few balloons to bursting, you can get a sense of the range that you get at. These subjects don't do that. So non-invasive modulation of right prefrontal activity can modify fairly unique human traits of altruistic behavior and the control of self-motivated impulses. And the lateral prefrontal cortex, particularly on the right side, appears to be a critical neural substrate for this function. The way I've been thinking about it is as follows. There is a sort of genetics that lead to personal characteristics. Every one of us is less self-centered, less self-motivated, or more self-motivated, I guess, depending on any number of variables, among other genetic variables, and, of course, outside world variables, from upbringing to influences from the social convention, the cultural expectancies when we grow up and where we live. And at any given time point, there is a fight between these two influences that have to be balanced out as we reach decisions, make choices, or guide our behavior. Ultimately, it is a conflict of ambiguity that requires, on occasion, and at least what maybe Freud would have called repression, the activity in the right lateral prefrontal cortex to hold and to dampen down these self-motivated behaviors to allow social conventions and cultural expectations to exert their full control and impact on our decision-making. When that fails, then you have a variety of different, ultimately, pathological behaviors. Impulsive self-centered behaviors with disregard to cultural and social conventions are a hallmark in a large list of neurological and psychiatric disorders. Traumatic brain injury, frontal dementias, mood disorders, personality disorders. Addictive behavior, not only is there an abnormality in reward, there is an abnormality in the risk-taking behavior and the decision-making process. Eating disorders, ultimately, as I shall eventually make an argument, it might fit the same bill. And if this is so, then understanding the underlying cognitive neuroscience may provide an opportunity for translational, interventional opportunities. So can we, by modifying activity in the right lateral prefrontal cortex, in the same way as in normal subjects, makes them less willing to take risk, make some of these disorders behave normally? I want to give you a few examples. This is a study that Felipe Freni has conducted, looking at cue-provoked nicotine craving. So the subjects, all of which are smokers, view a movie of somebody lighting up and smoking a cigarette. They rate their craving before and after. Transcranial DC current stimulation is applied either to the left or to the right. Then they rate their craving thereafter. They see a next movie, and again, rate their craving after that. The question is, does modifying activity in the right or the left prefrontal cortex, lateral prefrontal cortex, modify the craving that this exposure to the stimuli generates? At baseline, these subjects are matched, some sham left or right-sided stimulation groups of subjects. There is no stimulation applied here, and all of them show a nice increase in their craving after watching the movie. But you can see that this craving decreases much faster in those subjects that get stimulation to the left or the right, their lateral prefrontal cortex, particularly so in those that get to the right, but it's actually not significantly different. Those that get sham stimulation decrease significantly less. And with re-exposure to the movie, another cue coming here, those that got sham stimulation increase rapidly again, much like they did the first time around, whereas those that got TDCS to either right or left show a dampen response. So that in the context of having now modified the activity in the prefrontal cortex, the response to the next cue is significantly decreased. Paolo Baggio has looked at very similar design or the same design, but in alcoholics, cue-provoked alcohol craving. He found essentially the same results. I'll show them to you in a different way. Instead of showing you the time course over time, let me just show you the overall effect. So the reduction in craving, in percent of craving, in response to the second cue. And you can see that while sham stimulation has essentially no effect on the craving with the second cue around, the reduction is about 25 or even greater percent with left versus right. There is no significant difference between these two, but the trend is there for the right dorsal prefrontal cortex stimulation to decrease the craving further than the left. One final example. John Campodron has been looking at cocaine addicts and looking at cocaine craving using repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation rather than DC current stimulation. And what you see here is the decrease in the visual analog scale reported craving in the subjects after the stimulation and the effect lasting for a few hours after 4 hours being back. This is not cue-triggered. This is just simply self-reported craving in subjects that wanted to stop using cocaine. Now, perhaps a particularly nice example to think about this is the situation with obesity. And I'd like to finish with this story, sort of translating what I've been telling you about into the realm of obesity. To illustrate this unique human character of certain behaviors and conditions that I try to emphasize. Obviously, eating has a lot of homeostatic control mechanisms, and there is certainly reward gratification aspects to it. We like to eat certain things more than others. But in humans, eating has become a very elaborate behavior with a lot of cultural and social messages linked to it. If you're from Spain and people come over to your house, you have to offer something to eat. That's just simply the way it is. Whether you're hungry or not, you sit and eat. You don't eat a lot, but you eat something. And if you offer something to eat and they sit there and don't eat anything, you better know them really well, because it's sort of odd. You should eat what they offer you, at least something, at least try it and tell them how good it is, even if you don't like it. So there's lots of messages going on. A lot of what we know about how eating behaviors is regulated come from very nice models of food intake regulation appetite regulation that are based on animal models. I won't spend much time with any of them other than to point out that all of these models do recognize that there must be some sort of higher centers at work, and exactly what those higher centers are is unclear from these models. But it is different in human societies, I would argue, than in animal societies. There is a variety of different ways of communication and elaborate behaviors that have developed, where obesity in certain African cultures is actually a very nice, good thing to have. If you can afford it, you should eat as much as you can. Conventions of what is at least pleasing to the eye or not pleasing to the eye, what is way too thin and what is not way too thin, what is the way that people should look. And it spans all the way to having sort of moral undertones, out with the bad and in with the good. This uniquely human dimension of eating, I think, comes particularly clear when you look at extreme examples. And Bobby Sands, who went into hunger strike because motivated by his political beliefs, gives particularly striking illustrations of this fact. He points out that this is a kind of fight, to control his body tendencies on the basis of his beliefs. And this is something that humans are able to do. We are able to do this. We don't always do it, but we can. Now, what is interesting is that there is a lot of data from all kinds of different fields suggesting that the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, the lateral prefrontal cortex, is critically engaged in food intake in humans, more so than in animals. The Gourmand syndrome regarding Terry Landis described some years ago is a consequence of damage to the right prefrontal cortex because of traumatic brain injury generally. It leads to a passion for eating, generally of very nice, good, selected foods. Patients with frontotemporal dementias, particularly when they affect the right prefrontal cortex, develop hyperphagia, and this correlates, the amount of hyperphagia, in fact, correlates positively with the amount of right frontal atrophy, not left frontal atrophy. Klein-Levine syndrome is characterized by hyperphagia, and the amount of hyperphagia, again, is correlated with the amount of hypoperfusion in any number of different measures. Arias showed it to be correlated with the hypoperfusion with SPECT. On the other hand, hyperactivity of the right prefrontal cortex leads to hypophagia. There's a few case reports of patients with epileptic foci to the right frontal area, particularly the right frontal lobe, develop anorexia-like syndromes that resolve when the seizure focus is controlled with anti-epileptic medications or with surgery. And dietary restraints in normal subjects is correlated with the amount of right-sided predominance in the activity in the EEG. This gives you a correlation of asymmetry, the amount of hypoactivity of hyperactivity on the right being correlated with the dietary restraint. Now, if you look at obesity specifically, again, the right dorsolateral prefrontal cortex appears to play a particularly critical role. Those subjects that are obese but that stick to a diet show higher activation of the right dorsolateral prefrontal cortex after a meal than those that fail to maintain long-term weight loss, as shown by Del Parigi. And to bring it back to this experimental data that I was showing you, there is a variety of cognitive neuroscience tasks, behavioral tasks, that have been used to show a dysfunction of the right prefrontal cortex in obesity. For example, I've been telling you about the risk task and have shown you this data from Daria showing that the right-sided stimulation, not the left and not sham, significantly decreased performance. As it turns out, performance in this task appears to be different for subjects that have a BMI of less than 25 and subjects that have a BMI of greater than 25. Obese people show a tendency to perform on any number of risk tasks in the same manner as normal subjects perform when their dorsal prefrontal cortex is suppressed. This has led us to this idea that maybe this is a particularly nice example of this reflective versus reflexive model that I've been trying to illustrate, where there clearly are a variety of different mechanisms, homeostatic and reward mechanisms, for example, that are part of reflexive eating pathways that are ultimately leading towards self-preservation, self-centered behaviors. You want to eat what you have in order to be prepared for the potential situation where you may not have access to food, kind of argument, a very Darwinian way of thinking about it. But interdependence and altruistic behavior, ultimately reflective behavior, calls for taking into consideration all kinds of other cultural, social, and so forth undertones in making the decision. And for this, uniquely human aspects of eating in this case, prefrontal cortex appears to be particularly critical, as shown by these different areas of evidence. What Alonso is doing now is actually applying the same kind of approach that I've shown you with the drug abuse, transcranial DC current simulation, a transcranial magnetic simulation, and see whether indeed eating behavior is changed by the stimulation. We know that craving of food is changed. Uher has shown this, and we have also. The question is, can it be changed in such a sustained way that it actually leads to greater sticking to diet and making a difference in the sort of the overall BMI and activity levels of these subjects? So just to summarize, what I've tried to tell you is that the lateral prefrontal cortex, particularly on the right, exerts a repressive control onto self-centered behaviors and impulses. It represents the switch between reflexic and reflective modes of operation. And in a larger context, I hope that these experiments illustrate that insights from cognitive neuroscience can be translated into clinical applications, enabling us to address uniquely human aspects of behavior or disease. Perhaps one should think of sort of the next frontier of cognitive neuroscience, going beyond the understanding of the neural substrate of behaviors and developing true translational applied clinical cognitive neuroscience. Just as a caveat, the influence and control of behaviors that appears to be possible with brain simulation techniques may harbor the temptation to use these techniques for the whim in sort of uncontrolled ways. It appears to be fairly powerful ways of modifying behavior. It's non-invasive, it's relatively simple, and I think early ethical debate is needed to apply these techniques, and particularly studies in normals in the appropriate context and for the appropriate goals. Just want to finish up acknowledging the people that actually have done the work that I've been telling you. Daria, who is now with Ernst Fair in Zurich, started us off with this ultimatum game and risk tasks, and been showing you experiments of all these folks who are still in Boston and who I greatly enjoy working with. Thank you very much. Yes, so if I may repeat, the first question is for the developmental timeline of this lateralization. I think it's a very interesting question, but we don't have any data on it. We have done a lot of safety studies in the meantime to start applying the stimulation to children. I think we are there, but we haven't gone there yet. If the lateralization develops in paralleling some sort of myelinization / hormonal influences, then there might be, in fact, a biological substrate for this lateralization to take a certain timeline. And it might indeed be different for girls and boys, as might be predicted from some of these sort of developmental studies. I'm sorry?
No children or adolescents have been used for an ultimatum game?
Not that I'm aware of, not sufficiently to play to see when they develop altruistic punishment behaviors. There is some studies sort of transculturally, and there appears to be large differences depending on the culture, as you might predict. Your second question had to do with what? I'm sorry.
Are there any cases of left-sidedness?
Yeah. We haven't found them, and we've looked at handedness as one variable. There is some data suggesting that in men and women, the amount of laterality for some of these tasks may be different. So if you look at not the ability to disrupt the performance with the TMS, but the laterality of EEG power or the functional imaging, for example, or the impact of lesions, that there is a greater laterality in men than there is in women. We didn't find any difference, and we tried to power the study sufficiently to actually be able to look at that, but we couldn't find it. We did select out right-handed people, though, and so if one starts looking at left-handers, you might find a difference there.
One question that comes to mind is these disruptions that you described with both right and left. Stimulation. And I wonder...
Why?
There are probably a number of different explanations, but the one that I was interested in is you are focusing on either one or the other in the model, but experimental results show the result of both. And the question is, do you think that there's some sort of intermediary balance issue there?
Yes, so the bilateral effect, when Shirley stimulated both the left and right side, one with anode and one with cathode, was both sides with different polarities, and so the effect was greater than one side alone. But in that case, where you basically are increasing activity in one and decreasing it in the other, or vice versa, there was no laterality of the effect. So either one seemed to have the impact. That certainly was not what we predicted. So that was surprising, because the prediction was that it would be opposite modulations. That wasn't the case. And exactly why that is, we don't know. One could hypothesize that if you tilt out of that when we're looking at unilateral stimulation, that we are fundamentally modifying activity in one side, and in fact there is an interhemispheric attempt to adapt to that, and so there is a modulation of the contralateral side as well. And of course, with TMS, we know from work from a number of groups, among others Spear and others here at NIH, that if you target the dorsal prefrontal cortex with RTMS, with repetitive TMS, and do a PET study, that there is some effects at the side, but striking effects on the other hemisphere that go sort of in the opposite side than what you would be applying. And so perhaps that is part of the issue that we're seeing, that when we do right-sided stimulation, our effects might in part at least be driven by these interhemispheric interactions, and that we're simply maximizing those by doing the opposite modulation in the two sides. But, yes?
I'm wondering what the time resolution you have is for modifying behavior in this way. Is this something that's happening over half an hour, or can you pair on a trial-by-trial basis and kind of do a back correlation, figure out which trials are stimulated and which were not?
Yeah. So the question is whether one can get sort of good chronometry of the effects of the stimulation by doing the stimulation on a trial-by-trial basis. I hope that we'll get there, but we are not there yet. So far all we've done is either an offline stimulation, applying stimulation for 30 minutes and then testing the subjects for 30 minutes, or 10 minutes and testing subjects for 5 or 6 minutes, or the TDCS where we're continuously stimulating. What we're right now actually doing with some of these tasks is there is MEG data and EEG data on the temporal profile of the decision making, and so based on that one might predict when you need to stimulate to try to disrupt the activity precisely at the time when the dorsal prefrontal cortex may come online. Yes. Yeah, that you can modulate. So the question is, how long do you modify the behavior for? And it does depend on the duration of your train, but you can capture that, and we did. So you can design your task so that you're basically testing the subjects in blocks serially after you apply the stimulation. On average, and this is a ballpark figure, but on average, the duration of the behavioral impact is about half the duration of the train that you apply. So if you apply stimulation, at least for the magnetic simulation, if you apply magnetic simulation with 1 hertz for 10 minutes, you get about 5 minutes worth of disrupted behavior, and then it sort of comes back. If you do 20 minutes, then you extend it. Yes?
Separate out the cognitive
Mm.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. The question is, could it be that the effects are related to impact on working memory or attentional tasks and so forth? And it's a great question, and I should have pointed that out, so thank you. The only way you can do it is you test for it. So that's what we did. So we did working memory tasks, a two-back task. We did a Stroop task to see whether there was an interaction effect that could be there. We don't see an effect on those tasks, and we do see the effect on the ultimatum game. But that's a very good question and an important one. Yeah, there was another question up there. Yeah, so the question is how do subjects perceive the stimulation and how do they explain making the choices as related to how it feels? And that's something that I've been very interested in as well. And so we debriefed the subjects afterwards and tried to get a sense of what they think went on. What it feels like is different for the TMS and the TDCS. For the TMS, it's done offline, so they get the stimulation, and then when they're performing, there is nothing going on. But when they're getting the stimulation, they have a clicking noise, a tapping sensation, some facial twitching, and they tolerate it well, but there is a lot more to it, and they do see where the coil is being placed and so forth. In the TDCS condition, they feel nothing. They feel a little bit of tingling ramping up, but then literally nothing. I mean, they are truly blinded. They have no idea whether the thing is on or off and have no way whatsoever of knowing whether it's an autolocothodal stimulation. So in that sense, those results are particularly nice. And in fact, Leo has made the point that it is a particularly nice tool to blind subjects in this kind of designs. So in that sense, subjects are not feeling anything. The blocks are long enough, and they are intermixed enough in the different offers and conditions that subjects are not necessarily very aware of how much an effect they've shown. But they generally, some of them anyway, do become aware that they tended to reject more or to accept more, depending on what modulation. And generally, if you ask them, they just say, just felt like it. I didn't like the face of that proposer or something like that. I mean, they just come up with some explanation that seems to be fairly random. It generally not the fact that they just wanted to get out of there, because the response time goes down. And what I was concerned with is that they may say, I had enough, and they were just responding. And so that we may just simply be engaging more impulsive responses and that's it. That's not what they report. They just report that something made them decide this way, and they ascribe some explanation to whatever is going on. Generally not the stimulation. Yeah, so the question is what impact this has on orbitofrontal cortex, or whether it is related to orbitofrontal cortex impact. And I've been telling you about stimulating and targeting the dorsal prefrontal cortex, but when you stimulate any one area with any one of these techniques, your impact is not limited to the area that you target, but in fact, spreads and has a knock-on effect in any number of other areas. Tony Valero has elegantly shown in our lab that even in anesthetized cats, you have an impact on the targeted area and distant areas strictly by the strength of the connections between the area, very tightly correlated, the amount of impact that you get with the connectivity between areas. So if you target an area like the dorsal prefrontal cortex that has a lot of connections to any number of other areas, just because of that, you're going to have an impact on other areas. And the only way to be completely sure that the effect is related to the lateral prefrontal cortex and not to one of these knock-on effects would be to actually go directly to those areas, which in the case of the orbital frontal cortex, we really can't go to. Is the first caveat. The second caveat is that there is some spread of the activity. And so, for example, we target dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, but it is likely that to some degree we're also getting insula, for example, because there is shunting of current in the CSF. And so that shunting will actually, if you model it, predict that some of the effect will get to the insula. Despite of those caveats, though, I think that the effect of the lateral prefrontal cortex is different than the orbitofrontal cortex, and that while the orbitofrontal cortex is certainly engaged in goals and has been shown to be involved in some of these tasks and the primate work that you mentioned, I think that the lateral prefrontal cortex, at least that's the argument that I'd like to make, is related to sort of a different aspect of judging the behavior and judging the decisions. So it's not that area is the site of any one decision, but that it is imposing activity and imposing a control on ultimately orbital frontal cortex, perhaps, or middle frontal cortex. Ultimately, I think that the only way to be sure is actually convert it into an experimental paradigm and do these kind of tasks in the PET scanner, for example, and then stimulate while you actually record the impact that it has on the ongoing brain activity, not just locally, but across the brain.
Thank you very much, Alvaro.